At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Let's settle this once and for all, shall we?
I'll go with Mnuchin.
The new Treasury Secretary had some things to say today besides how to pronounce his name. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday, 23 February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. First of all, credit where credit is due for that pronouncer on the Treasury Secretary's name. Mr. Mnuchin was on CNBC this morning. Second of all, I will tell you what he said. Some pretty interesting stuff. Economically ambitious stuff, really. Starting with this. Mr. Mnuchin figures the White House is going to have a tax reform plan done by August. This August, which is sooner than soon in the legislative time. The broad outlines include a substantial cut to corporate taxes and reduction in some individual taxes as well. Also, an almost certain and substantial increase in the federal debt. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more now on the political and economic consequences of it all.
If President Trump's tax plan and resulting budget turn out to be anything like candidate Trump's tax plan, they're going to increase deficits and add to the national debt. Scott Greenberg is an analyst at the Tax Foundation.
The latest version of the Trump tax plan would increase the U.S. deficit by at least $2.6 trillion over the next decade and up to $5.9 trillion.
Howard Gleckman is a senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center.
He can use rosy economic assumptions to make it look like it won't, but the numbers are the numbers, and in the end, it almost certainly will.
Now, the problem here is that many Republicans have staked their reputations on fiscal conservatism. So will there be a showdown between Trump and Republicans over this? Probably not, says Norm Ornstein with the American Enterprise Institute.
Most of those who talk the most about fiscal conservatism do it when there's a Democrat in the White House and then abandon it entirely if they can get tax cuts when there's a Republican.
If the deficit is substantial, there is a concern it could hurt the economy long term.
That's what many of us would call a sugar high.
That is, massive tax cuts could be a form of stimulus when the economy doesn't need one. The risk is the economy overheats and we get inflation. Robert Bixby runs the Anti-Deficit Concord Coalition.
It will slow economic growth from what it would be otherwise.
There are a lot of milestones between now and passage of any budget. The House needs to weigh in, as do key Republican senators. But as of now, higher deficits look likely. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Here's another piece of tape from Mr. Mnuchin this morning.
I think if you look at long-term growth, we have underperformed where we need to be. And we believe that we can be competitive and get back to sustainable growth of 3% or more.
That is also ambitious because it has been a very long while since we've had sustained economic growth of 3% in this country. And it's a goal that is well beyond what most informed estimates say is possible. From our bureau at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman looks at what 3% or more might take.
You want the economy to grow faster, you need businesses producing more, buying more machines, consumers buying more houses, furniture, clothing. But you need something else as well, increasing productivity. Brad McMillan at Commonwealth Financial explains it this way. It's like handing a worker a jackhammer instead of a pickaxe.
A person with a jackhammer is simply more productive. It lets each individual person generate more growth, and that lets everybody be better off.
So, how does the Trump administration propose to unleash more spending, generate higher productivity, more jackhammers? Through tax cuts, regulatory reform, and government spending on infrastructure.
A bridge, a sewer system, a highway are going to generate benefits for the next 20 years, 30 years.
Corporate tax reform could also boost GDP, according to Michael Bale at U.S. Bank. He says so far in the economic recovery,
companies have been using cash flow to increase dividends and buy back stock.
Lower the tax rate, reduce regulations on business, and he says they'd be more likely to build domestic factories, upgrade equipment, invest in the workforce. But speed up growth a lot, and that could create bottlenecks in the economy, like finding enough new workers, says Michael Strain at the American Enterprise Institute.
An aging population that's aging out of the workforce, and when you have a political environment that looks to be increasingly hostile to immigration, it's hard to imagine the labor force growing fast enough to get us to 3.5% growth.
Strain thinks the administration's policies may bump up growth in the next few years, but not to the levels the Treasury Secretary is predicting. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This just in, fast food is in trouble. McDonald's is cutting its drink prices. Starting in April, you can get soda any size for $1, smoothies and the rest of them for $2. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports that this latest in a long string of promotions comes as the all-day breakfast menu gambit, and McDonald's seems to be losing steam.
There's a number fast food industry analyst Andrew Alvarez from Ibis World keeps watching, the number of people walking into McDonald's.
In 2013, consumer guest counts decreased by 1.6%. In 2014, guest counts decreased by 4.1%. And in 2015, they decreased by 3%.
Now, last year, the company still sold $36 billion of hamburgers and fries in the U.S. But how long could it increase profits from a shrinking number of people? This helps explain why Mickey D's is experimenting with things like sprucing up restaurants, offering three sizes of Big Macs, and now selling pop and coffee on the cheap. Industry consultant Aaron Allen says competition is fierce.
Food trucks and delivery and convenience stores and grocery stores now competing more like restaurants. It's been for a very difficult operating environment.
Beverages carry fat margins. So in theory, McDonald's can sell cheap Coke pain-free or force suppliers to gulp down whatever losses. The company hopes supersized soda for $1 will lure away a would-be Starbucks customer. Jefferies analyst Andy Barish says doubling down on its basic menu probably isn't the answer.
Brand McDonald's is somewhat boxed into its products, you know, we all know, and it's a little bit harder to reach beyond that and drive their business.
One competitive disadvantage for McDonald's, and really all the traditional fast food giants, is that consumers are hungrier for healthier, more locally sourced type options. Making pop cheaper isn't going to change the 540 calories packed into the typical Big Mac. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
McDonald's shares today up 0.3%. Elsewhere on Wall Street, a whole lot and not much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Lizzie O'Leary, the host of our weekend program, has been on the road of late. Three cities of roughly the same size, all with very different economies. We caught her today in Gillette, Wyoming. Hey, Lizzie.
Hi, Kai.
Tell me a little bit about Gillette, first of all, and why you're there.
So we're here as sort of the second stop in this series that we're doing where we travel across the country. We've been talking to mayors around the country for the past 2 years about their jobs in three similarly sized cities, Dalton, Georgia, Gillette, Wyoming, and Corvallis, Oregon, but they all have really different economies and different populations. So Gillette is an oil, gas, and really coal town. I mean, so much so that when you fly in here, you see an open pit coal mine from one side of the plane and grassland on the other. I mean, this is really coal country. And Wyoming produces about 39% of the nation's coal. Those numbers are from 2014. But so this is really part and parcel in everything here.
All right. So talk to me for a second then about how they're feeling about the current political conversation. Because as you know, and as we've said on the radio, I don't know how many times, the president has promised to bring back all those extractive jobs. How do the good people of Gillette, Wyoming feel about that?
So they're very hopeful about that. I think there is optimism that he will do that. We've heard that from a couple of different people. You know, we came here to visit the mayor, and I'm going to play a little sound from her. Here's what she had to say. This is Louise Carter King, the mayor of Gillette.
I think our optimism will just keep going that the country will still need coal for the next 30, 40 years. There are so many uses for coal that we haven't even thought of yet. And that's why I just think we should not turn our backs on 600 years of coal.
600 years, that's sort of the reserves that people say are around here. Right. And I should point out that this has been a tough time leading up certainly to the election. There are about 500 layoffs last year. Some of those jobs have come back. And we did talk a little bit, Kai, about something that you've covered a lot, which is this question of the decline of coal. Well, regulations are a part of it, but a lot of this is just changing the way we use fossil fuels. And, you know, coal mining has become more automated. And at the same time, natural gas is very cheap.
Yeah, it's that whole market forces thing. So Scott Tong had a piece yesterday from Illinois about how Eastern Coal maybe is seeing now that coal wasn't so great just in the long term. Are the folks in Gillette looking at that sort of thing, and are they taking steps to, to prepare for life after coal?
Yes and no. I guess I would say they are taking steps to prepare for life with a different kind of coal, or coal being used in a different way. I mean, the economy here, I cannot tell you how tied it is to extractive industries. Like, we went to this amazing recreation center where there's like a huge climbing wall, multiple gyms, pools, all of that stuff. It's all paid for by, you know, taxes, and the money for those taxes comes from the energy sector. At the same time, we went to a place yesterday called Atlas Carbon, which is an activated carbon plant. They are making filtration systems for power plants and for water. And they even, you know, it's kind of gimmicky, but like, they brought out a bunch of different products, you know, including Biore nose pore strips that are made with activated carbon to say, hey, there is other stuff we can do with this resource. But yeah, this is sort of a constant battle here. Do they want a different kind of economy, or one that uses the resources they already have a little bit differently?
Right. Lizzie O'Leary is on the road again this week. She's the host of Marketplace Weekend. Stories coming, what, this weekend on the air for you?
A couple weeks.
Couple weeks. All right. Lizzie, thanks.
Thanks, Kai.
Sometimes economics turns conventional wisdom on its head. Exhibit A today, carbon and its profit potential. Fighting climate change is usually taken to mean keeping as much carbon as possible out of the atmosphere. But there is another way, as Marketplace's Jed Kim reports now from the Sustainability Desk.
The carbon that comes out of factories, out of coal plants, out of our cars' tailpipes, it's all looked at as a waste product that has to be dealt with. Some companies, though, are spinning that waste carbon into, well, not quite gold.
We take a inexpensive precursor material and we coat it like a pearl.
Brent Constance is CEO of Blue Planet, and the coating he's talking about is calcium carbonate, limestone. They take the carbon dioxide that factories collect, that would otherwise vent out of smokestacks, run it through tiny nanotubes in their machine, and convert it into carbonate. The longer they run the process, the thicker the coating of limestone that builds up, and the bigger the rock. He shows me a drum of whitish rocks his company has made. And while they're not pearls, they can fetch a good price.
Material comes in for a couple dollars a ton, and then we coat it, and then it actually goes out for between $70 and $100 a ton.
These rocks will be used to make concrete, and that's where the biggest environmental value lies, locking carbon away in bridges, sidewalks, buildings.
Every yard of concrete that we make, it's about half a ton of CO2 sequestered per yard.
Blue Planet is developing units that factories and power plants can use to turn their carbon into a money stream of rocks for concrete. So far, Constance says they've got contracts in California, Canada, and Mexico. About 2 hours north, depending on traffic, in a lab on the UC Berkeley campus, the young tech company Opus 12 is sciencing something else out of carbon dioxide.
This is running right now. Do you have any idea what it's producing? I don't actually know. I have to go ask.
Kendra Kuhl is a co-founder of the company. In front of her is the toaster-sized prototype they've developed. That she doesn't know what it's making is actually a testament to its potential. Depending on which of their membranes they've installed, the device can make a lot of different useful chemicals out of CO2 and water.
Essentially, exactly what a plant does, right? You take carbon dioxide in a plant and you make sugars. Where instead of sugar, we're making a range of different compounds.
Things like acetone, methane, carbon monoxide. Compounds that are useful in manufacturing or pharmaceutical making. Compounds that normally have to be bought.
It actually ends up being, depending on the market volume, fairly high value. And so we can make a large profit margin.
What Opus 12 and Blue Planet are doing is shifting carbon from waste into commodity. If this kind of push succeeds, it could even drive carbon harvesting. Rather than simply reducing how much carbon goes into the sky, industry could begin pulling out what's already there. Noah Deitch is the executive director of the Center for Carbon Removal, which works to grow the entire field of carbon capture. He says technological solutions are still in the early stages.
It's stuck in a chicken and egg situation today, where there aren't markets to support it, and so there hasn't been a lot of industry investment. As a result, there aren't a lot of technologies that you can go point to and say, hey, we should do a lot more of that.
Deitch is concerned that kind of push might not happen under the Trump administration. He says he's already seeing a lull in progress as investors wait to see what environmental rules will still apply. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Hearing people say horrible things about me, I'd be lying if I say that wouldn't bother me.
Well, yeah, but still, you want the job, right? First, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 34 today, 10%, 20,810. Holy cow. The NASDAQ shaved off 25 points, about 0.4%, 58.35. The S&P 500 gained a tiny fraction, 23.63. The research institutes at Google and a Dutch company have cracked cryptographic technology, one of the main building blocks of internet security. But Google's parent company, Alphabet, down 10% today. Yahoo down 1.2%. Automakers, as we told you yesterday, are calling on the new EPA chief to pump the brakes on tougher fuel economy standards. Ford off 0.8% today. Fiat Chrysler down 2.75%. Turns out that Taco Bell shell introduced last month, made entirely of fried chicken, is going to be short-lived today. Yum Brands, which owns Taco Bell, finished dead down about 0.5%. I don't know that I would try it myself. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, and John Kelly at Homeland Security were in Mexico City today for meetings with their counterparts. Judging by the comments at the post-meeting news conferences, things got a bit tense behind closed doors. President Trump has, among other things, as you know, said he wants to renegotiate NAFTA, which has raised economic eyebrows in industries on both sides of the border. Not, though, in energy, because oil and gas were specifically excluded from NAFTA. Mexico has been trying to modernize its energy sector of late with help from foreign companies, ExxonMobil among them, see also former CEO Tillerson, as I mentioned, by having those companies work with Pemex, the Mexican state-owned oil company. But as Lauren Madelon reports now from Mexico City, Pemex itself might have to be reformed before more American companies decide to invest.
Pemex Tower is unmistakable on Mexico City skyline. The nerve center of Mexican energy is a monument to oil and gas when both produced massive income. No longer. When Mexico ushered in energy reform 3 years ago, inviting foreign players into the market for the first time since it was created in 1938, crude oil sold for $100 a barrel. Now it's worth about half that. Mexican energy analyst David Shields says low prices have revealed a host of problems at Pemex.
Because it is overstaffed, it is overdebted, and it has all kinds of burdens that it has inherited over the years. When oil prices were high, and high prices bring inefficiency, overspending.
Pemex finances are messy. The Mexican government keeps slashing its annual $20 billion budget while also using Pemex as a piggy bank, taking away money it does make to build schools, hospitals, and in one case, a baseball stadium. The credit rating agency Moody's has downgraded Pemex, making it harder for the company to borrow money. Jorge Piñon heads the Latin America Energy Program at the University of Texas at Austin. He says Pemex needs to cut the fat.
You have to swallow very unsavory medicine in order to take care of the patient's illness.
He says Pemex is taking its medicine, slashing jobs, dumping pension obligations, but he says changing Pemex's corporate culture won't be easy.
So when you have an institution like Pemex that for 75 years has been a state monopoly, it is inherently corrupt in the way that it does business.
Pemex acknowledges that some of its own workers may be stealing oil. It's hired a foreign company to set up surveillance cameras at its pipelines. Pemex says the current gas shortage in Mexico is in part caused by oil theft. Jose Manuel Carrera, Pemex Director of Business Development, says corruption is an issue.
It's a fact. We need to face it.
And there's something else. Brazen nepotism, says Cleanto Leite. He runs the Mexico office of Brazil's Braskem, Latin America's largest petrochemical company.
With somebody retired, he could indicate that he wanted his son or his nephew or somebody from his family to take his post. This is absurd.
Pemex's Carrera says the company is working with its union to stop that practice. Despite these challenges, U.S. oil, gas, and electricity producers have entered Mexico's deregulated energy markets. ExxonMobil, Chevron, California Sempra Energy, and New York-based Blackstone, to name a few. Other U.S. companies have shown an interest. But former U.S. ambassador to Mexico, Antonio Garza, who now lives in Mexico, says they're unlikely to make a move until Pemex gets its books in order.
Does Pemex need to reform? I'd say, you bet. And most Mexicans would say, it should have been done yesterday.
Mexico's energy reserves have symbolized sovereignty and national pride, even before foreign companies were kicked out almost 80 years ago. Mismanagement was ignored when oil prices were high, but now there's a real urgency to modernize Pemex and bring in foreign capital and expertise to rescue it. In Mexico City, I'm Lorne Madelon for Marketplace.
I'm going to play a piece of tape right now that's going to sound more pointed than it's intended to, but the public record is what the public record is, and also, it's a great way to set up our next story.
If you're disappointed by your elected officials, grab a clipboard, get some signatures, and run for office yourself.
President Obama, obviously from his farewell speech in Chicago about a month, 6 weeks ago, advocacy groups say that since the election, thousands of people from every part of the political spectrum have expressed interest in running for office. Or, if you put it another way, have decided to apply for a job that is often difficult and underappreciated. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that story.
Mal Gazeef is 38, and until recently, she'd never considered running for political office.
Never. It didn't interest me. It definitely didn't seem to jibe with my experience and skills.
But since the election, Zeef, who's a corporate lawyer and lives in Alexandria, Virginia, has already sought out and been appointed to a city commission for children, youth, and families. She's a registered Democrat, and now she's thinking about running for school board.
For me, the time of just sitting back is over.
Republicans are inspired, too. Allie Higgins, who's 26, works as a political fundraiser for two Republican congresswomen in Washington, D.C. She's considering moving to New Hampshire, where she grew up, and running as a Republican for Congress.
This election, really, I got to see two awesome women win. And so those were, you know, those are the people that really inspire me to want to kind of throw my hat in the ring.
Higgins has some hesitations. A big one, as a politician, you're constantly under public scrutiny, and you have to have thick skin. She says that might be hard for her. She's used to working behind the scenes as a fundraiser.
Hearing people say horrible things about me, I'd be lying if I say that wouldn't bother me, you know?
There are other things to worry about, too. Becoming a politician is basically starting a new career, and it can mean taking a pay cut. Also, some people are afraid of fundraising or public speaking, and they're not sure where to start. That's where groups like She Should Run come in. It's a nonprofit that encourages women to run for office. It offers online training courses on how to parlay leadership experiences into public service and how to prepare for a campaign.
What we're seeing overall in the country is a desire to be more connected, more hands-on in our communities.
CEO Erin Loefs-Cutraro says more than 9,000 women, Republican, Democrat, Independent, have signed up since the election. Previously, the group was seeing interest from about 150 women a month. Another group called Run for Something recruits progressive millennials to run for down-ballot races. It connects them with organizations that offer training and skills like political fundraising. Amanda Littman is the group's co-founder.
But if you don't know those things exist, you don't know how to ask for them.
More than 6,000 people have signed up in the month since the group launched, and Littman says they're sorely needed. In 2016, nearly 42% of state legislative races had only one major party candidate.
We then ask ourselves, why don't people show up to vote?
By recruiting aspiring politicians, Littman and others are trying to make sure there's a reason for voters to show up at the polls. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, another installment of our Every Now and Then series, Things the President of the United States Says at Meetings. Last week, you might remember it was invoking the vernacular Target when the CEO of Target introduced himself. Today?
Thank you, Mr. President. Denise Morrison from Campbell Soup Company.
That's great. Good soup.
Thank you.
A lot of sodium, though, right? Holy cow, look at the time we got to go. The Dow up 34 points today, about a 10th percent. The NASDAQ down, though, 25 points, 4/10 percent. S&P 500 basically flat. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor, for now anyway, John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.